Thanks for joining me, and welcome to the latest pour of the Coffee Cast.
God damn, Jimmy. This is some serious gourmet shit. Me and Vincent would have been satisfied with some freeze-dried Taster's Choice, right? And he springs this serious gourmet shit on us. What flavor is this?
Knock it off, Julie.
What?
I don't need you to tell me how fucking good my coffee is, okay? I'm the one who buys it. I know how good it is. I buy the gourmet expensive stuff because when I drink it, I want to taste it. But you know what's on my mind right now? It ain't the coffee in my kitchen.
Really, Jimmy? Whatever could it be? On second thought, don't tell us. Wisely put, from theinformation.com this week. Facebook employees are upset that their internal Facebook posts are being leaked to the media. It must feel awful to have private information they put on Facebook end up in someone else's hands without their knowing it. Facebook is reeling from a series of revelations about private user data being leaked to Cambridge Analytica, a shadowy political consulting firm that did work for the Donald Trump campaign. This from Timothy Lee at Ars Technica. Recently, reporters from the New York Times and the Observer of London told Facebook that Cambridge had retained copies of private data for about 50 million Facebook users. Facebook says Cambridge promised in 2015 that the data would be deleted. Facebook responded to the new revelations by banning Cambridge and several of its associates from Facebook. But not too long ago, the controversy surrounding Facebook's ties to Cambridge and its handling of private user data more generally has mushroomed. British members of Parliament accused Facebook of misleading them about the breach and asked CEO Mark Zuckerberg to come to the UK to clear up the issue personally. The scandal has attracted broad public interest because Cambridge did millions of dollars in political consulting work for Donald Trump's presidential campaign. Some reports have portrayed the firm as the masterminds behind Trump's election victory and the stolen Facebook data as a key part of Trump's digital strategy. But while the firm's controversial psychographic techniques have attracted a lot of attention, there's reason to doubt that they were actually used in the 2016 election. The larger concern for Facebook is that the Cambridge leak could be seen as just one example of a broader pattern of lax handling of consumer user data. Facebook offers users privacy controls that are supposed to limit who has access to their data, and Facebook has promised the Federal Trade Commission that it will ensure those settings are honored. Yeah. So today, we're going to talk a little about Facebook, its policies, and what is ripping its credibility and its long-term viability apart. And as the current occupant of the White House becomes more and more uncontrollable, a new story from Gabriel Sherman in Vanity Fair about Amazon and Jeff Bezos in the crosshairs. Imagine the leader of a democracy using his immense powers to destroy his political enemies. Speaking of destroying political enemies, emergency room pediatrician Jill McCabe, the wife of former Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe, writes about doing your civic duty and facing the reckless powers of those high above who abuse it. Let's pour this pot. So, wherever you're listening, if you're just loading an AOL 2.0 installation disk, making friends at MySpace, CopyServe, Prodigy, or no matter what dial-up internet where you are, welcome. My mission is to make it as compelling a listen as you'll find it. I'll talk about all kinds of subjects because people listen to what interests them. And sometimes, it's the Coffee Cast.
And now, freshly poured, the Coffee Cast with Tom. The Coffee Cast is that good broadcast where we afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted liberally. We take no prisoners, cede no quarter, brook no hoo-ha, and assuage no dumb fuckery. Now is your coffee mate, Tom.
And as we're on the story of Facebook, BuzzFeed News has been just knocking it out of the park, left and right and left and right again. As of Thursday, March 29th, Growth at Any Cost, top Facebook executive defended data collection in a 2016 memo and warned that Facebook could get people killed. Facebook Vice President Andrew Bosworth said that questionable contact importing practices, subtle language that helps people stay searchable, and other growth techniques were justified by the company's connecting of people. Now, here's the thing about Facebook. I want you to know from personal experience. The thing with Facebook is this kind of unapproachable intangibility, the thing about them. Being in tech, a lot of the work that I did in advertising had to be involved, obviously, with Facebook, obviously with Twitter, obviously with Instagram and all of the other social media, because when advertisers wanted to have certain presence online, those were the go-to places. So over time, the very beginning, I was very interested to see, what is this platform? And I came of age in the AOL era, which seems to be like absolutely forever, but before... Just that's almost like BC. That's actually last century. So when I got involved in that, there are things that are similar between the two, between Facebook and that, and then there are some they're absolutely not. I mean, the sophistication of the platform and how they scrape information is an entirely different thing altogether. But what happened when I was on Facebook for the first time, I felt as if I could communicate with some people. And yet, if I see something that is completely ridiculous, I always ridicule it. I always mock it. For some people, they think that gets me into a lot of trouble. I don't care. I really think that if something is really destructive, or if it's sick, or if it's wrong, I'm going to call it out. And frankly, especially if it's conservative or ridiculous and it comes from that swamp, I'm going to say something about it. I've been off and on Facebook a number of times. I've come back for a number of reasons, because there might happen to be some kind of work that precluded that I needed to post things on Facebook, so I had to have a Facebook account. The last couple of times that I was on Facebook, I completely held back. And as 2016 exploded, everything else occurred, and we come to find out just the horrific practices Facebook did with Cambridge Analytica and vice versa, the more I just felt like, you know what, I don't want to be a party to this anymore. I have some very, very good friends that are on Facebook. That's good. That's fine. They can enjoy their company. If they want to get in touch with me, they can pick up the phone. They can talk to me face by face. I don't care. They can email me, whatever. So my relationship with Facebook is watching this flawed platform come to life, become exploited in such a way that it literally is, we'll give it to you free. You just surrender all of your privacy, all of your data, every single thing about you. That's just too goddamn bad. After all, like Zuckerberg said, he was in the fine print when you signed up. You should have known. And that's always typical of them, or any kind of new tech, any kind of predator approach. And that's what I really feel about that. So when all this stuff about Facebook exploded and started happening, I started thinking, like, fucking damn right, serves them. Serves them absolutely right to have this actually happen. And I'm glad. I might be gone by a month now. I don't care. I'm glad. I'm glad I'm no longer a part of this. Hopefully, I will never, ever step back. This whole thing about the internet is so vexing. On one hand, when I first got on, it blew my mind, the fact that I could actually technically, I could connect with somebody. I could text, I could talk, I could, write, we could communicate, we could exchange stuff back and forth. We have this incredible opportunity to explore, share information, data, science, everything about the world. And yet at the same time, individuals choose to wrap themselves in bubbles of delusion and tribalism, racism, belief systems, and shelter themselves from everybody else, almost as if the very internet itself has become a reflection of the more darker side of humanity. The internet has become that shaded characteristic. It has become, the promise has been betrayed by the very nature of the darker nature of humanity. As I see Facebook go down, and I couldn't be happier, I can't help but think that those who know about those darker things and exploit it, those are the ones that should be dragged into the light and exposed. So let's go on with the story. This is just fascinating. Facebook Vice President Andrew Buzz Bosworth said that questionable contact and porting practices, this is their kind of talk, everything was justifiable to them. On June 18th, 2016, one of Facebook's CEOs, Mark Zuckerberg's most trusted lieutenants, circulated an extraordinary memo weighing the cost of the company's relentless quest for growth. We connect people, period. That's why all the work we do in growth is justified. All the questionable contact, importing practices, all the subtle languages that helps people stay searchable by friends, all of the work we do to bring more communication in, the work we will likely have to do in China someday, all of it. That's his tech talk. That's Buzz Bosworth, his VP at Facebook. So we connect more people, he wrote in another section of the memo. That could be bad if they make it negative. Maybe it costs someone a life by exposing someone to bullies. Maybe someone dies in a terrorist attack coordinated on our tools. The explosive internal memo is called The Ugly and has not been previously circulated outside Silicon Valley's social media giant. The Bosworth memo reveals the extent to which Facebook's leadership understood the physical and social risks of the platform's products carried. Even as the company downplayed those risks in public, it suggests that senior executive had deep qualms about the conduct that they are now seeking to defend. And as the company reels amidst a scandal over improper outside data collection on its users, the memo shows that one senior executive, one of Zuckerberg's longest-serving deputies, prioritized all-encompassing growth over all else, a view that has led to questionable data collection and manipulative treatment of its users. Now, we may get into the full post. Facebook was unable to provide comment the time that BuzzFeed put that out. Now, Bosworth is one of a small inner circle at Facebook. He joined the company in January 2006 from Microsoft. That is nearly an eternity. That is 12 years ago. And over the years, has been deeply involved in everything from newsfeed and groups to Facebook's anti-abuse systems and its virtual and augmented reality efforts. Bosworth, one of the company's most outspoken employees, has recently emerged as an outspoken defender of Facebook through his Twitter account. He responded to this particular story saying, "My statement on the recent BuzzFeed story containing a post I wrote in 2016. The Bosworth is known inside the company for his bluntness. The memo's basic is classic Boz because it speaks to the majority of Facebook employee views, but it's also polarizing. So what? He's definitely a guy who isn't very diplomatic. He blunder into internal debates and internal comms and would tend to keep an eye on what he's doing and posting," one former senior employee told BuzzFeed News. "The memo is classic him because it speaks to the majority of Facebook employee views, but it's also polarizing. Totally, he doesn't mince words. This is clearly a post meant to rally the troops." Wonderful. The Bosworth memo, which stresses the extent to which Facebook was built on growth tactics, reads as a statement of corporate principles, including phrases like "what we do" and "what we believe." And speaking of "our work" and "our imperative." In the memo, he argued that Facebook believes its mission of connecting people is so important that anything it does in support of it is de facto good, even if it allows to do true, even catastrophic harm to others. "The ugly truth is that we believe in connecting people so deeply that anything that allows us to connect more people more often is de facto good. It is perhaps the only area where the metrics do tell the true story as far as we're concerned," he wrote. "That isn't something we're doing for ourselves or for our stock price. Really. It is literally just what we do. We connect people, period." There is no record of Zuckerberg's response to this memo. However, a year later in August 2017, Bosworth was tapped to run the company's consumer hardware efforts. A former employee who was unhappy about the lack of accountability at Facebook in light of the company's role in recent global crises, surfaced with the post earlier this month. It still remains live for current workers to read. In a statement given to BuzzFeed News after publication of the story, Zuckerberg wrote, "Boz is a talented leader who says many provocative things. This was one that most people at Facebook, including myself, disagreed with strongly. We've never believed the ends justify the means. We recognize that connecting people isn't enough by itself. We also need to work to bring people closer together. We changed our whole mission and company focus to reflect this last year. Bosworth published the post to Facebook for employees' eyes only a day after the shooting death of a Chicago man was captured on Facebook Live, the company's live streaming product. Earlier that year, Facebook had been dealt a significant blow when Indian regulators rejected the company's free internet program. That spring, the company also faced significant backlash following reports that human curators sometimes demoted conservative news sources in the company's trending news sections. The natural state of the world is not connected, Bosworth wrote. It is not unified. It is fragmented by borders, languages, and increasingly by different products. The best products don't win. The ones everyone uses wins. That I did a little bit of paraphrasing there. With more than 2 billion users, Facebook's relentless quest for growth led the company to grow its market capitalization to more than $450 billion. As it was in 2016, the social network is still shut out of China, possibly explaining Bosworth's statement about the work we will likely have to do someday in the world's most populous nation. One former employee who spoke with BuzzFeed News noted that they remembered the post and the blowback it received from some workers at the time. It was one of Bosworth's least popular and most controversial posts, the employee said. There are people that are probably still not in his fan club because of his view. Bosworth may be a polarizing figure inside the company, according to the former employee, who said the post was viewed as Bos being Bos. A former senior executive, however, pushed back on that, acknowledging the debate within some circles, but describing the menu as super popular internally. Right now, there's a tremendous amount of soul-searching internally, they said. Views like Bos's are being raised retroactively and debated now with more vigor. There was some debate when he posted it, but there were some people who likely just stay out of it. But now they feel different. I assume that there's going to be intense debate over this and so many other strategic vision statements in the coming weeks as part of their reckoning. But it didn't take long after the memo's publication for the worst of Bosworth's statements to be realized. On June 30th, 2016, an Israeli teen was stabbed to death by a terrorist who had boasted on Facebook of his plans to die as a martyr. In July, the company was sued by the parents of five people who had allegedly been killed by Hamas since June of 2014. For Bosworth, that may have just been part of the ugly. Quote, in almost all of our work, we have to answer hard questions about what we believe, he wrote in the memo. We have to justify the metrics, make sure they aren't losing out to a bigger picture. But connecting people, that's our imperative, because that's what we do. We connect people. The memo. Andrew Bosworth, June 18th, 2016. A lot of this I've already read before, and I don't want to go and repeat myself. But I want to get to the part that is the meat of it. He says, I know a lot of people don't want to hear this. Most of us have the luxury of working in the warm glow of building products consumers love. But make no mistake, growth tactics are how we got here. If you join the company because it's doing great work, that's why we get to do that great work. We do have great products, but we still wouldn't be half our size without pushing the envelope on growth. Nothing makes Facebook as valuable as having your friends on it. And no product decisions have gotten as many friends on as the ones made in growth. Not photo tagging, not newsfeed, not Messenger, nothing. In almost all of our work, we have to answer hard questions about what we believe. We have to justify the metrics and make sure they aren't losing out on a bigger picture. But connecting people, that's our imperative, because that's what we do. We connect people. This story from BuzzFeed News by Ryan Mack. Growth at any cost. The top Facebook executive defended data collection in a 2016 memo and warned that Facebook could get people killed. So this story was so controversial when it came out on BuzzFeed that almost immediately the executive, Bosworth, who claimed death and terrorism were justified by the site's growth, said that he was just being provocative. And this is from Gizmodo. Andrew Bosworth claimed that he didn't agree with his own statements, even as he wrote them. The purpose of this post, like many others I've written internally, was to bring to the surface issues I felt deserved more discussion with the broader company. Bosworth is now writing on Facebook saying, quote, I don't agree with the post today and didn't agree with it even when I wrote it. You're about to hear what that is. Quote, why did you write a post you don't agree with? He says, It was intended to be provocative. This is one of the most unpopular things I've ever written internally, and the ensuing debate helped shape our tools for the better. So, basically, the idea was the Pee Wee Herman, I meant to do that. The purpose of the memo, Bosworth said, was to surface issues he believed deserved attention. Having a debate about hard topics like these is a critical part of our process, and to do that effectively, we have to be able to consider even bad ideas if only to eliminate them. This just seems to be a self-inflicted wound. I'm not even sure how they can deal with the spate of bad news that's happening to them. This seems to be absolutely typical of Facebook, because something truthful will come out, and then all of a sudden Facebook will, an executive will step forward and say, well, you know, maybe I didn't really mean that. What is the damage at Facebook? When I come back, we'll read some of the internal employee Facebook posts. I'm Tom, and you're sipping a fine cup of the Coffee Cast. From Casey Newton in The Verge, here are the internal Facebook posts of employees discussing today's leaked memo. Now, the publication of a June 2016 memo describing the consequences of Facebook's growth at all costs triggered an emotional conversation at the company on Friday, March 30th. An internal post reacting to the memo found employees angry and heartbroken that their teammates were sharing internal company discussions with the media. Many called on the company to step up its war on leakers and hire employees with more integrity. And of course, we're talking, of course, about the memo from Andrew Bosworth, who had said that the company's core function is to connect people, despite consequences that he repeatedly called ugly. So Bosworth started with damage control. He distanced himself from the memo, saying in a Twitter post that he hadn't agreed with those words even when he wrote them. Wow, what a surprise. He was trying to galvanize a discussion around the company's growth strategy, he said. CEO Mark Zuckerberg told BuzzFeed that he had not agreed with the sentiments in the post at the time, and that growth should not be a means to an end in itself. We've recognized that connecting people isn't enough by itself. We also need to work to bring people closer together. After publishing the memo, Bosworth deleted his original post. While I won't go quite as far as to call it a straw man, that post was definitely designed to provoke a response, Bosworth wrote in a memo obtained by The Verge. It served effectively as a call for people across the company to get involved in the debate about how we conduct ores amid the ever-changing mores of the online community. The post was of no particular consequence in and of itself. It was the comments that were impressive. A conversation over the course of years that was alive and well, even going into this week. That conversation is now gone, Bosworth continued, and I won't be the one to bring it back for fear it will be misunderstood by a broader population that doesn't have full context on who we are and how we work. Facebook and Bosworth declined to comment. Nearly 3,000 employees had reacted to Bosworth's memo when The Verge viewed it, responding with a mixture of likes, sad, and angry reactions. Many employees rallied to Bosworth's side, praising him for sharing his feelings about sensitive company matters using blunt language. Others criticized Bosworth for deleting the post, saying it fueled a narrative about the company that it had something to hide. Deleting things that usually look bad in retrospect, one wrote, please don't feed the fire by giving these individuals more fuel. For example, Facebook execs deleting internal communications. If we are no longer open and transparent, and instead lock down and delete, then our culture is also destroyed, but by our own hand. Dozens of employees criticized the unknown leakers at the company. Leakers, please resign instead of sabotaging the company, one wrote in a comment under Bosworth's post. Wrote another, how fucking terrible that some irresponsible jerk decided that he or she had some God complex that jeopardizes our inner culture and something that makes Facebook great. Several employees suggested Facebook attempt to screen employees for a high degree of integrity during the hiring process. Although we all subconsciously look for signal on integrity in interviews, should we consider whether this needs to be formalized in the interview process, one wrote. Wrote another, this is so disappointing. Wonder if there is a way to hire for integrity. Facebook employees wondering if there is a way to hire for integrity now. We are probably focusing on the intelligence part and getting smart people here who lack a moral compass and loyalty. Well, just look at the top. Other employees said it would be difficult to detect leakers before they acted. I don't think we've seen a huge internally leaked data breach. Oh, right. Okay. All right. You have a leaked data breach, okay? But when it comes to the leaked data breach of tens of millions of people that has huge consequences to democracy, it's like nothing to you guys. But I'll continue with this. But I've also thought on our open but punitive stance was particularly vulnerable to suicide bombers, one employee wrote. We would be foolish to think that we could adequately screen against them in a hiring process at our scale. We have our representative share of sick people, drug addicts, wife beaters, and suicide bombers. Inside Facebook? Wow! Some of this cannot be mitigated by training. To me, this makes it just a matter of time. That employee was followed up to say, oh my God, I just ran back to my pewter from a half-eaten lunch with food in my mouth. Apologies to our brothers and sisters in the Austin office for my insensitive choice of metaphors, words. I'm sorry. Another theory floated by multiple employees is that Facebook has been targeted by spies or state-level actors hoping to embarrass the company. Keep in mind that leakers could be intentionally placed bad actors, not just employees making a one-off bad decision, one wrote. Thinking adversarially, if I wanted info from Facebook, the easiest path would be to get people hired into low-level employee or contract roles. How about your fucking policies? Another wrote, imagine that some percentage of leakers are spies for governments. A call to morals or problems of performance would be irrelevant in this case because dissolution is the intent of those actors. If that's our threat, and maybe it is, given the current political situation, then is it even possible to build a system that defaults to open, but that is able to resist these bad actors, or do we need to redesign the system? So your system is falling apart while democracy is falling apart. Sucks to be you. Several employees shared concerns that the leaks had removed some of Facebook's luster. What, the stock price? The company is routinely cited as among some of the best places to work in America. If this leak fucking continues, we will become like every other company where people are hesitant to discuss broad-reaching, forward-looking ideas and thoughts. That only the very average ideas and thoughts get discussed and executed, one employee wrote, making them average companies. Another employee responded, will become, seems like we are there. The leaks also became cause for discussion about the company's internal sharing tools. Facebook runs on its enterprise product, Facebook for Work. One employee wondered whether the critics of leakers had ignored incentives for sharing created by the product itself. It's a nuanced thought worth sharing in full. This might bore the hell out of you, but there may be nuances in this, so I'll just read it. The non-employee Facebook user base is also experiencing a similar shift. The move toward ephemeral and direct sharing results from realizing that social media posts were shared broadly and are searchable forever can become a huge liability today. A key difference between the outside discussion and the internal discussion is that the outside blames the Facebook product for nudging people to make those broad sharing decisions years ago, whereas internally, the focus is entirely on employees. So it's your fault you posted naughty pictures on Facebook, and it's searchable. Another employee made a similar plea for empathy. Can we channel our outrage over the mishandling of our information into an empathy for our user's situation? Can the deletion of a post help us better understand delete Facebook? How we encourage ourselves to remain open while acknowledging a world that doesn't always respect the audience and intention to that information might just be the key to it all. Maybe we should be dogfooding that. God, these are the conversations that they have inside. These are the words that they use. Now, for his part, Bosworth promised employees that he would continue sharing candid thoughts about Facebook, but said he would likely post less. Of course, when you step out of your trailer park and every single footstep is steps on a rake, well, it's just going to hurt. When posting comes with the risk that I'll have to blow up my schedule and defend myself to the national press, he wrote, you can imagine it is an inhibitor. Sucks to be you. So in the ending of the day, here's Bosworth's full memo to the company today. I've never heard Bosworth, don't even know what his voice sounds like, but I'm going to just give it a shot. So I may have covered some of this before and I won't repeat it again, but it will skip to the last paragraph. This is the very real cost of leaks. We had a sensitive topic that we could engage on openly and explore even bad ideas, even if it's just to eliminate them. If we have to live in fear that even our bad ideas will be exposed, then we won't even explore them or understand them as such. We won't clearly label them as such. We'll run a much greater risk of stumbling on them later. Conversations go underground or don't happen at all, and not only are we the worse off for it, so are the people who use our products. So that's part of the memo that seems to be setting the place on fire. From Bosworth, the vice president at Facebook. I mean, I get it. I get it when you're creating something new, any kind of product, you have to have open source thinking. You have to be able to think and be able to project what can the worst possibly happen with your product. I get it. I understand all that. In this case, I think what's gotten out is that Bosworth and those in key positions at Facebook are afraid to acknowledge or admit that they no longer have any control over the monster that they have created. And that last story by Casey Newton in The Verge. Here are the internal Facebook posts of employees discussing today's leaked memo. When I come back, the fallout with Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. What are the long-term consequences? I'm Tom, and you're quaffing yet another cup of the Coffee Cast. From Nick Bilton in Vanity Fair, this is a slow roll. Silicon Valley insiders think that Facebook will never be the same after the Cambridge Analytica scandal. Late last Friday, Paul Grewal, Facebook's vice president and deputy general counsel, wrote a seemingly straightforward blog post on the company's newsroom page, indicating that Facebook was suspending the data firm, Strategic Communications Laboratory, and its political unit, Cambridge Analytica, for policy violations, in particular, for obtaining user information without corporate approval. It was an egregious breach, but it appeared as though Facebook was handling it responsibly, rather than fumbling around for an articulate response as the company had in the wake of revelations that its platform had facilitated the dissemination of fake news that influenced Donald Trump's election. Facebook was trying to get ahead of the bad press, to get out front, as they say, in the lingua franca of corporate communications. We're committed to vigorously enforcing our policies to protect people's information, Grewal wrote. We will take whatever steps are required to see that this happens. We will take legal action if necessary to hold them responsible and accountable for any unlawful behavior. As we all know now, of course, Facebook wasn't offering a bare-chested confessional. Instead, a day later, the New York Times, in partnership with The Guardian, published a blockbuster expose that accused Cambridge Analytica of exploiting the Facebook data of some 50 million people. Grewal's note, it appeared, was simply a dastardly attempt to forestall yet another calamitous story about Facebook surrounding the election. This attempt to appear out front is totally disingenuous, the Times' Gabriel J.X. Dance, who worked on the initial story, wrote on Twitter. To some cynical journalists or techno-skeptics, this maneuvering might seem like Facebook just being Facebook, that the Cambridge scandal is merely the latest in a litany of privacy intrusions, that Facebook's de facto response is, as Dance noted, disingenuous. But this scandal is really different, and everyone in Silicon Valley knows it. Since the story broke, a significant investor and entrepreneur who's worked in tech for over 2 decades recalled to me that the incident reminded him of what happened in Microsoft in the 1990s, when years of pugilistic corporate behavior caught up to the company in the form of significant antitrust regulation. One tech investor put it a little bit more succinctly: this is a slow roll into serious fuckery. They're fucked. Indeed, the repercussions are massive in both immediate and longitudinal ways. Just a couple of days into the Cambridge crisis, Facebook's stock dropped more than 20 points, which led to its market capitalization fall by tens of billions of dollars. Now, we know it's fallen a lot more since then. Senators Mark Warner and Amy Klobuchar have called for Mark Zuckerberg to testify before Congress. A British MP sent Zuckerberg a letter asking him to testify before Parliament. The Federal Trade Commission is exploring whether Facebook violated the terms of a 2011 consent decree around privacy. A shareholder has filed a class action lawsuit. Facebook's chief security officer, Alex Stamos, is reportedly leaving the company after battling with executives about the company's response to Russian involvement in the 2016 election. A hashtag delete Facebook campaign has surfaced across social media and is gaining steam. On a more prosaic level, as one entrepreneur who has personally spent time with Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg put it to me, this scandal has likely eliminated the potential for any of the company's leaders to ever credibly run for public office. God, that's good. Another person who has worked with Zuckerberg in the past pointed out that the CEO's hopes of getting his company into China are now less likely. Why would a country that controls the internet let Facebook, which clearly allows its partners to manipulate people's minds with their data, let Facebook operate there? Scandals surrounding privacy issues are part of Facebook's DNA. Back in his Harvard day, Zuckerberg told a friend that he could use the Facebook, as it was called back then, to find out anything on anyone. I have over 4,000 emails, pictures, addresses, SNS, Zuckerberg proudly wrote to his friend. People just submitted it. I don't know why. They just trust me. Dumb fucks. Zuckerberg was still a teenager when he wrote that note, but that glaring blind spot has become a leitmotif of his tenure as an executive. In 2010, I wrote a piece for the New York Times pointing out that Facebook's privacy policy was so confusing you had to navigate through 50 different settings with more than 170 options to make your information private. Back then, the company's privacy statement was longer than the U.S. Constitution. In general, though, Facebook has survived it all on account of its staggering addictiveness, and because Wall Street was making so much money from all the stuff advertisers could do with that data. The closest that the company came to any actual legal trouble occurred when Facebook settled a privacy suit with the Federal Trade Commission after the data that seemed private was repeatedly shared and made public. In some regards, however, Facebook's ill-fated history of privacy concerns may pale in comparison to the impact of its proximity to the slimy executives at Cambridge Analytica, who bragged about what they could do with that data. In an undercover video posted by Channel 4 News, Mark Turnbull, the managing director of Cambridge's Political Global, spoke at the time about how the company uses all that data to twist the public to its will, to take data and turn it into propaganda, and how much of that same data is willing to get it in order to win a campaign. Quote, the two fundamental human drivers when it comes to taking information on board effectively are hopes and fears, Turnbull said in the video, which was secretly recorded. And many of those hopes and fears are unspoken and even unconscious. You didn't even know that there was a fear until you saw something that evoked a reaction from you. They would not be able to tap into those hopes and fears if it wasn't for the information that they were able to glean from people using the data they get from Facebook. As Turnbull pointed out, our job is to drop the bucket further down the well than anyone else to understand what are those really deep-seated underlying fears and concerns. It's no good fighting an election campaign on the facts, because actually, it's all about emotion. In the short term, The one saving grace for Zuckerberg is that the people who took advantage of the data manipulation and ad targeting to win office, namely Donald Trump and various Republicans who support him, either by choice or political necessity, may not want to regulate a company that could, if left to its own devices, be used again in 2020 to retain the White House. Brad Parscale, the digital expert who had worked previously for Trump's campaign, has bragged repeatedly since November about how his ability to micro-target people using Facebook and a partnership with Cambridge Analytica that got Trump elected in the first place. Given that Parscale is not running Trump's 2020 re-election bid, he will presumably endeavor to ensure that the President of the United States doesn't block his capacity to manipulate people on Facebook by tapping into the electorate's hopes and fears. Something tells me that if the Trump campaign can't take advantage of Facebook's data powers in 2020, the Republican strategy could be in major trouble. Now that Cambridge has suspended its reprobate chief, Alexander Nix, it seems unlikely that Trump's allies, including Jared Kushner and Robert Mercer, will be able to take advantage of the data they allegedly stockpiled during the last election. As for the social networks, the continually falling stock prices of Facebook and Twitter is indicative of how Wall Street thinks this is all going to go down. In short, not well. Consequences. Whether Facebook is inevitably broken up is nothing more than a guessing game right now. As one investor recently told me, even if it's dismantled, Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, and Oculus are split into separate companies. It won't really change all that much from a consumer standpoint. It would, however, change a lot from a data standpoint. The more that you use Facebook products, the more Facebook's products get to use you, collectively knowing more about you than you know about yourself. Creating big, beautiful walls between that data could really hurt Facebook's ability to micro-target its ads the way it does so incredibly well today. What is clear to everyone, whether you're Facebook, Cambridge, Parscale, and Trump, or just an average user who likes to post pictures of your kids on the social network, is that the data the company collects is unfairly being used to manipulate the 2.25 billion people who use the platform to sway opinion, incite outrage, create division, and Facebook just can't pretend to get out in front of its problem any longer. Something has to change. That from Nick Bilton in Vanity Fair. This is a slow roll. Silicon Valley insiders think that Facebook will never be the same after the Cambridge Analytica scandal. Let's cleanse the palate, shall we? I'm Tom, and you're sipping on a delightful cup of the Coffee Cast.
Circuit crew, world changes moves, springs in again, ripped dark glass. There's a one who likes all our pretty songs, and he likes to sing along, and he likes to shoot his gun, but he knows not what it means.
Come to me.
Knows not what it means, and I say.
From the mighty Gabriel Sherman in Vanity Fair. Trump is like, how can I fuck with him? Trump's war with Amazon and the Washington Post is personal. For the first time in Donald Trump's presidency, the West Wing soap opera appears to be in hiatus, with many of its starring characters, Gary Cohn, Hope Hicks, either permanently offstage or with much reduced roles, John Kelly, Jared Kushner. Currently, there's one star. And that's a situation Trump is obviously enjoying, and his new freedom is used to focus ever more closely on his perceived enemies and obsessions. Amazon, whose owner Jeff Bezos also owns the Washington Post, is currently the main target. Trump has ripped into Amazon in recent days, claiming in a series of tweets that Jeff Bezos's tech giant benefits from billions in subsidies from the U.S. Post Office while skirting sales taxes. Quote, let me see if I can do Biff. Unlike others, they pay little or no taxes to state and local governments, use our postal system as their delivery boy, causing tremendous loss to the U.S., and are putting many thousands of retailers out of business. Trump tweeted on Monday. He wrote, only fools are worse at saying that a money-losing post office makes money with Amazon. They lose a fortune, and this will be changed. Also, our fully paying tax retailers are closing all stores all over the country. Not a level playing field. The tweets caused Amazon stock to plunge 5% on Monday. Now, according to four sources close to the White House, Trump is discussing ways to escalate his Twitter attacks on Amazon to further damage the company. He's off the hook on this. It's war, one source told me. He gets obsessed with something, and now he's obsessed with Bezos, said another source. Trump is like, how can I fuck with him? According to sources, Trump wants the post office to increase Amazon's shipping costs. When Trump previously discussed the idea inside the White House, Gary Cohn had explained that Amazon is a benefit to the Postal Service, which has seen mail volume plummet in the age of email. Trump doesn't have Gary Cohn breathing down his neck saying, you can't do post office shit, a Republican close to the White House said. He really wants the post office deal renegotiated. He thinks Amazon's getting a huge fucking deal on shipping, if you can believe that. Advisors are also encouraging Trump to cancel Amazon's pending multi-billion dollar contract with the Pentagon to provide cloud computing services, sources say. Another line of attack would be to encourage attorneys general in red states to open investigations into Amazon's business practices. Sources say Trump is open to the ideas. The White House did not respond to a request for comment. Gee whiz, do they ever. Even Trump's allies acknowledge that much of what's fueling Trump's rage toward Amazon is that Amazon's CEO, Jeff Bezos, owns the Washington Post, sources said. Trump doesn't like the New York Times, but he reveres it because it's his hometown paper. The Washington Post he has zero respect for, the Republican close to the White House said. While the Post says that Bezos has no involvement in newsroom decisions, Trump has told advisors he believes Bezos uses the paper as a political weapon. One former White House official said Trump looks at the Post the same way he looks at the National Enquirer. When Bezos says he has no involvement, Trump doesn't believe him. His experience is with the David Peckers of the world. Whether it's right or wrong, he knows it can be done. And that? From Gabriel Sherman in Vanity Fair. I'm Tom, and you're enjoying yet another cup of the Coffee Cast.
Smart because I can't see what you mean, and I can never understand what you say. What you want, I never ask, like it's not worth looking for. Feet on the ground and my back against the wall. Never ardent to ask that whispered wall. It's all set in the eyes of a talk, and it's still not said that it's already fall. Light on, son of a bitch. Light on, you won't be missed and you still don't matter. What's to me?
It takes good folks to stand up and to punch back, not just at the bullies, but to run for office. It can be an act of selflessness. It could be an act of great patriotism. And Jill McCabe, whose main career is an emergency room pediatrician, decided to run for office. She didn't win her race, but Donald Trump used that as a battering ram against her husband, who happened to be the FBI deputy director Andrew McCabe. In a piece in the Washington Post, Jill McCabe, the president attacked my reputation. It's time to set the record straight. This is Ruth Marcus. She's the deputy editorial page editor, and she explains why she asked Jill McCabe to break her silence.
If you listen to her talk about what it's like for her with patients in the emergency room, you honestly, you really just fall in love with her. You just get this sense of somebody who is really fiercely committed to her profession and really fiercely committed to her patients. The whole reason that she ran for public office was that she wanted to see Medicaid expanded.
She's a doctor.
Who's a pediatric emergency room physician at Inova Loudoun Hospital.
When she would go door knocking with the kids, Andrew not only wouldn't knock on doors with them soliciting votes, wouldn't even drive them to the door knocking. He never came to any of her fundraisers. Some of you may have seen a photo of the McCabes in which all of them are wearing McCabe campaign t-shirts. They were at a swim meet and they wanted to get a family photo to send to her parents. So her husband puts on, I think for a very brief period of time, this McCabe t-shirt. It ends up on Facebook. It becomes a cause célèbre and part of the set of accusations that, of course, Andrew McCabe is a partisan hack. So it would have been a pretty convoluted plot to get money to her during the campaign in anticipation that in the future, he would end up working on the Clinton email investigation. That's a little crazy, is what she says, and that makes some sense to me.
Jill McCabe writes, I am an emergency room pediatrician and an accidental politician, someone who never thought much about politics until I was recruited to run for state office after making a statement about the importance of expanding Medicaid. That decision, plus some twisted reporting and presidential tweets, ended up costing my husband, Andrew, his job, and our family, a significant portion of his pension my husband had worked hard for over 21 years of federal service. For the past year and a half of this nightmare, I have not been free to speak out about what happened. Now that Andrew has been fired, I am. Andrew and I met as sophomores in college at Duke University. He was interested in law, eventually law enforcement. I in medicine, eventually pediatrics. Andrew's a reliable Republican. I have voted over time both for Republicans and Democrats. As we have raised our children, I have tried to vote more regularly and pay more attention to the issues that affect our community. And with my work in a hospital emergency room in Virginia, I saw the impact of how government decisions hurt my patients, especially when the state decided not to accept the federal government's funding to expand Medicaid. I was providing care in the most expensive setting, the emergency room. And only once a patient's condition became more serious, because he or she had no other options. In addition, our state's decision was increasing the cost of healthcare for everyone, ultimately raising prices, premiums, and taxes, while thousands of patients suffered. The whole thing just made no sense. Then one day in 2014, an entourage of politicians came through the ER, and a reporter pulled me aside to ask how Medicaid expansion would affect my patients. I did not think any more of it until a year later, when I received a voicemail asking whether I might be interested in running for the state Senate. I was stunned and went home and told Andrew. And we laughed about how crazy the idea was. A few days later, I got another call. Clark Mercer, the chief of staff to then-Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam, asking me to at least speak to Ralph, who was a pediatric neurologist. I was moved by Ralph's story about how he had used his medical background to advocate for the needs of the children he serves. I started to become more interested, thinking, here's a way I can really try to help people on a bigger scale than I do every day. While I was considering the possibility, Andrew and I went to Richmond to meet with various politicians, including then-Governor Terry McAuliffe. The subject of Hillary Clinton never came up. The story about her emails hadn't even broken when I was first approached by Northam. And the governor asked of me, all the governor asked of me, was that I support Medicaid expansion. Still, in thinking about running, one of my first concerns was Andrew and his job at the FBI, where he was the assistant director in charge of the Washington field office. I said to Andrew, if you think this is going to be a problem for you professionally, even if it's allowed, I won't do it. He consulted with the ethics experts at the FBI and committed to follow their advice. We tried to go even beyond what the rules required. Andrew kept himself separate from my campaign. When the kids and I went door knocking, he did not participate. He wouldn't even drive us. He would have attended one of my fundraisers, but never did. One day he put on a campaign t-shirt so we could take a family picture and share it with my proud parents. You may have seen it. It seems to have just taken a weird life of its own. But that was it, just a family picture at a swim meet. Meanwhile, my campaign received funding from the state Democratic Party and the governor's PAC, on par with what other candidates in competitive races on both sides of the aisle received. All those contributions were publicly reported, and of course, Clinton's emails never came up. If they had, I would have found that alarming immediately and reported it and likely pulled out of the campaign. I know enough from being married to Andrew for 20 years to know what is right, what is wrong. I lost my race in November 2015. It was disappointing and particularly hard for me because I've always been the kind of person who gives everything her all, but I felt good about my effort and enjoyed returning to a normal life. Almost a year later, everything changed. A reporter called my cell phone on a Sunday in October 2016, asking questions about contributions to my campaign and whether there had been any influence on Andrew's decisions at the FBI. This could not be further from the truth. In fact, it makes no sense. Andrew's involvement in the Clinton investigation came not only after the contributions were made to my campaign, but also after the race was over. Since that news report, there have been thousands more repeating the false allegation that there was some connection between my campaign and my husband's role at the FBI. After the 2016 election, I thought for a while that it was all over. At least now that President-elect Trump had won, he would stop coming after us. How naive that was. After then, FBI Director James B. Comey was fired, we knew that Andrew could be the next target of the president's wrath. Then, the president started tweeting about how the contributions to my campaign made it clear that Andrew and all the senior leadership at the FBI were corrupt and that he should be removed. It went one step further in the days before Christmas, when the president made threats related to my husband's retirement. To have my personal reputation and integrity and those of my family attacked this way is beyond horrible. It feels awful every day. It keeps me up nights. I made the decision to run for office because I was trying to help people. Instead, it turned into something that was used to attack our family, my husband's career, and the entire FBI. Nothing can prepare you for what happens when your life is turned upside down by current events. Nothing prepares you for conversations you have to have with your teenage children. Nothing prepares you for the news crews sticking out your house, your backyard, your place of business. Nothing prepares you for the fear you feel every time you receive a package from a stranger. I have spent countless hours trying to understand how the president and so many others can share such destructive lies about me. Ultimately, I believe it somehow never occurred to them that I could be a serious, independent-minded physician who wanted to run for office for legitimate reasons. They rapidly jumped to the conclusion that I must be corrupt as part of what I believe an effort to vilify us to suit their needs. Throughout this experience, my work has been a sanctuary. I walk into the hospital, and everybody there knows me as a professional. The patients know me as a doctor, and not a news story. It is not easy, but I have to put all of our challenges aside to focus on the patients and families I treat. Now that I can speak on my own behalf, I want people to know that the whole story that everything is based on is just false and utterly absurd. No matter what the path ahead, I have faith that our family will get through this. Despite everything, we are closer than ever. Andrew and I have amazing children and a support network that knows who we truly are. We will not allow ourselves to be defined by a false narrative. While I have no intention of running for office again, I believe in what my campaign stood for, and I still hope we can see our way to Medicaid expansion in Virginia. The patients who inspired me to run continue to come to the ER every day, and they need our help. And that from Jill McCabe, not only an emergency room pediatrician, but the wife of former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe. In the Washington Post, the president attacked my reputation. It's time to set the record straight. Thank you for joining me in emptying a pot of the CoffeeCast Facebook Faceplant Blend today. Thanks to Ryan Mack and BuzzFeed, Casey Newton in The Verge, Nick Bolton and Gabriel Sherman in Vanity Fair, Jill McCabe in The Washington Post, and Timothy Leonaris Technica. You can follow me on Twitter at The Coffee Cast. You can become a Patreon of The Coffee Cast, too. It doesn't take anything much to keep this show going. Just go to patreon.com/thecoffeecast or patreon.com/defendmedia. Remember, you can download a fresh Coffee Cast anytime at Stitcher and iTunes, Radio Public, TuneIn, Google Play, and now in the Progressive Voices app. Until the next pot gets brewed, I'll keep my eye on it to keep it fresh. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom.
Check out The Coffee Cast on Stitcher or iTunes. And thank you, dear listener, for your company.
This episode of The Coffee Cast was brought to you by AOL 2.0. AOL 2.0. Remember chat rooms? Remember you got mail? Soon, you'll have that same kind of nostalgia when you think back to the glory of Facebook. To get your free AOL 2.0 installation disk, just dial 1-800-SNOOCHIE-BOOCHIE-SNOOCHIES.
You are the new American society, the movers and the shakers.
Hold on tight to your dream.
You are the new coffee generation.
Because coffee lets you calm yourself down and picks you up. Coffee gives you the serenity to dream it and the vitality to do it. No other drink does that like coffee.
Hold on tight to your dream.
Join the coffee achievers.
Do your best.